I think we are all here to answer the call for amnesty for prisoners of Katrina. Am I right? You have to excuse me. I'm a little sort of discombobulated because I just got off a plane a few minutes ago. Because I was in Houston all day long participating in the Southern Human Rights Organizers Conference that also marks International Human Rights Day. And we were talking there about the importance of unity, the importance of uniting black communities, immigrant communities, Latino communities, the importance of thinking about black people, people of color in the southern United States, and people in the global South. So making the connections between the U.S. South and the global South. There was someone from Venezuela there, and we celebrated the recent election of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. There was a woman from Honduras who organizes women banana workers. It was really exciting. I mean, this is the kind of movement we need. This is what the South should be like. Amen. This is what New Orleans should be like. Yes, sir. Now, let's talk about human rights, because I think that's why we're here. Are there more lights? Can we put the lights up? Oh, yeah, that's a lot better. That's a lot better, because I'm actually not a performer. I came here to have a conversation with you, and I would like to see you. And, of course, this is my first visit to New Orleans since Katrina. And it's very special for me. I'm very moved. And I'm especially moved by the numbers of people who've come out this evening to talk about what we can all do to rebuild this city and to guarantee that it is rebuilt not as a city that focuses primarily on punishment and security and discipline in the prisons and in the schools, but to build a city that is habitable, to build a city that provides education and health care and recreation and all the things we all need in order to live decent lives. I want to talk about human rights. And already the United Nations Human Rights Committee is pressuring the U.S. government around a range of issues related to the prison industrial complex. The ACLU has been participating in these efforts to bring human rights violations in the U.S. To light within the international arena. And they say that these are some of the issues that the Human Rights Committee of the United Nations is pressuring the U.S. government around. First of all, the sentencing of children to life without parole. Second of all, the disproportionate incarceration of people of color. Yes. You know that there are more than 2 million people behind bars in this country. And you know that the overwhelming majority are people of color. And you know that here in New Orleans, if you consider that before Katrina, the population of New Orleans, I think, was about something like 66% black. But what was the population of Orleans Parish prison? Something like 90%, right? And what was the population of the youth facilities? There's like the youth facility that's called the Youth Study Group, the Youth Study, what is it called, Youth Study Center? I heard they call it Youth Starvation Center, right, YSC. And then there's another one?
It was
It, and the other one that's closed now, that population was something like over 90% black. There's something wrong with that. There's something seriously wrong. The Human Rights Committee also talked about militarization of the border. And I think it's important here in New Orleans, while we're all concerned about the impact of Katrina, to think about connections with other issues and to think about the extent to which the militarization that we see that is being used in places like Iraq is also transforming the border into an apparatus that makes too many people assume that the people on the other side of that wall are our enemies. And why are people in Mexico our enemy? Why are people in Central America our enemy? Well, for the same reasons that not too long ago, black people used to be represented as the enemies of white people. You know, as the competitors in terms of jobs. So think about the way in which that whole historical dynamic is being recapitulated, and now some black people are buying into it and participating in it. It makes no sense. The Human Rights Committee also said that racial profiling, especially now, we know about racial profiling of black people, right? I mean, that's been going on since slavery. But there's racial profiling of Middle Eastern people and South Asian people, and we should all be concerned about that as well. The Human Rights Committee listed the abuse of women in prison as a major issue that reflects the extent to which there are systematic human rights violations in the United States of America. And then, of course, the indefinite detention, extraordinary rendition, torture, all of that. And, you know, if we have time, we'll talk about the extent to which the prison has become the face of the United States of America all over the world. As a matter of fact, it is the prison that represents, I believe, the version of democracy that the U.S., and particularly George Bush, represents himself as offering to the world. And finally, the Human Rights Committee is pressuring the U.S. government around human rights violation in relation to Katrina, and particularly the discriminatory treatment that people who lived here in New Orleans suffered and continue to suffer. And it seems to me that the response to Katrina, or what we would call the lack of response, should lead us all to think about the connection between the ways prisoners were treated during Katrina and the way black people en masse were treated as a result of the hurricane. And I begin with this observation because of the tendency that we sometimes have to think of prisoners as criminals and to think of criminals as being very different from us. You know we do that, don't you? I mean, we can't help it. None of us can help it. Because that is the way we have learned to think about people who are on the other side of the walls. So I want to begin with a question. Why are we so willing to assume that anyone who happens to be in prison must be considered a threat to the well-being of those of us who are fortunate enough to inhabit what they call the free world? Now, oftentimes we obsess so much on criminals threatening our lives that we are unable to see the threats that emanate from government and corporations. And certainly during Katrina, the most devastating threat to people in New Orleans came not from the prisoners, many of whom spent several days on the freeway overpass before they were evacuated to prisons around the state, many of whom almost drowned, and probably some died. They just have not admitted it. What's your sheriff's name? Gusman or something like that? Now, the most devastating threat to people in New Orleans came not from the prisoners, but came from the government.
That's right. That's right.
The city government that ordered the city evacuated without providing transportation for those without cars or those without means of transport. The state government that wanted the military to enter New Orleans because they would be able to shoot to kill. Isn't that what your governor said about the military? And the federal government, especially George Bush, whose initial reaction was that aid for poor black people in New Orleans wasn't even worth interrupting his golf game. Now, who's a threat? Think about the irony of assuming that all prisoners are violent and threatening, and this is exactly what was said about black people in general during the whole Katrina experience. Every black person was a potential looter. Yeah, you remember what Kanye West said. The difference between looting and foraging or something like that. That was like racialized. You know, foraging was a white activity and looting was a black activity, although the activities were exactly the same. Now, I heard about this case involving a black woman by the name of Merlene Mattin, who was 73 years old at the time of Katrina, a church deaconess, a great-grandmother, and she was held in jail for over 2 weeks because she was accused of looting. And according to the New York Times and other media stories, she had evacuated from New Orleans. She'd gone to this town, Kenner. That's not too far from here, is it? Okay. She had gone to Kenner. She had taken her 80-year-old disabled husband in a car, and they were parked in a hotel parking lot. She went into the trunk of the car and got some clothes and some food, including some sausage. Cops saw her and accused her of looting the deli. And she goes to prison. She's actually sent, I think, to the state women's prison with a bail at that time for $50,000. And for 16 days, her family, with the support of a lot of organizations, lobbied to have her release. And it wasn't until September 16th, that's like about 16 days after the landfall of Katrina. It wasn't until the 16th of September when, incidentally, the Associated Press wrote a story or released a story about her case that she was allowed to leave state prison on her own recognizance. And it wasn't until this past January, that was like 6 months later, that charges were dropped. Now, just before Hurricane Katrina struck, a new law had gone into effect that allowed for harsher sentencing of people convicted of looting during an emergency situation. So a person convicted of looting during Katrina can be sentenced to 15 years in prison. 15 years. Now, we have to think about the term, the fact that that term, looter, is a racialized term. It already carries the implication of race. It already refers to black people. It's one of those ways in which overt racist behavior can be condoned because it's now colorblind, right? Looter is colorblind because you only have to say looter. You don't have to say black looter, right? Because the term black is already understood. And there are a lot of terms like that. There are a lot of concepts like that. As a matter of fact, racism to a large extent is colorblind these days, where it hides behind color blindness. And so I would like us this evening to think very deeply about the extent to which we live with racism, the extent to which we are influenced by racism, and the extent to which we, in large measure, accept racism as a fact of social life. I'm not saying that we're all racist. I'm not saying that we intend to accept the persistence of racism. What I'm saying is that we haven't developed the tools that allow us to recognize the ways in which racism persists. You know, oftentimes we can kind of intuit it, because we know that looter, we knew as soon as we heard that term, looter, we knew that there was racism there, didn't we? Yes. Now, you know, we have a lot of people going around the country trying to abolish affirmative action, and, you know, we have black folks like, what's his name from California? You know, I mean, I know his name, but I just don't like to say it because it makes my mouth feel, you know. Yeah, that Ward Connolly, who just led a campaign in Michigan to have affirmative action abolished there after he did it in California first and then in Washington. But I want to spend a few minutes talking about racism. Because I think a lot of us had been persuaded, perhaps before Katrina, that we were well on our way to rooting out racism. You know? That's what the government liked to tell us, right? I mean, that's the argument behind the anti-affirmative action push, that now we've all reached a level playing ground, right? And then what happens? Katrina hits. And people all over the country, all over the world, can't believe their eyes. And they say, this can't be the United States. They say, this reminds me of Africa. Didn't you hear people say that? Now, that might be true. And there's no reason to be ashamed of that. I think a lot of people said it and were ashamed of it. It was like, how dare we be associated with people from backward African countries? And you see, you know, I actually had a very different take on that word refugee. I really did. I mean, I don't know whether you want me to talk about it. Well, I'm telling you, I felt really sad when I heard people shying away from that term. Because somehow or another, it put black citizens in New Orleans in the same situation as Africans who were fleeing famine or fleeing genocide. And And my sense was that, but we need that kind of solidarity. We should recognize the similar. There's nothing to be ashamed of. There is poverty in New Orleans. There is poverty in Louisiana. There is poverty in the United States. And we know why there is poverty. It has nothing to do with the individuals whose lives are impoverished. It has everything to do with the corporations. It has everything to do with the government. And instead of fighting back against the government, against the corporations, we fight back against those who should be our friends and our sisters and brothers and our allies. And so I was thinking that if people hadn't gotten so upset about that word refugee and insisted on evacuee, well, you know, both work in my mind, we could have really talked about what it means for there to be refugees within the United States of America. And see, a lot of it was about insisting on citizenship. And, you know, as a black person who grew up in the South, I know how important first-class citizenship is. Because the first time I tried to vote, I could not vote. So I'm not saying that we not take citizenship seriously. But what I'm saying is that we cannot use citizenship as a way of making us appear to be better than those who do not have the citizenship. We are not superior by virtue of citizenship. What citizenship we have because we have struggled over decades, over centuries, and we should be proud of that, and we should be proud to share that with others who cannot claim that citizenship. And besides, I don't think we need, I think we need to be talking about global citizenship anyway. Yeah. I think we need to be talking about citizenship that's not based on a U.S. passport. Right. Now, anyway, that's okay. See it? I'm just on page 3 of my notes. Let me go back to my notes. Because I wanted to talk about racism. And I wanted to focus our attention for a minute on the three incidents in this country recently. Talking about the shooting of that young brother, Sean Bell, in New York on the morning of his wedding. The 50 gunshots that the police admit were shot that day. I'm talking about, what's his name, Michael Richards? Did you all see it? Did you? Because you can actually go online and you can see it. It was much, much worse than anything I had ever imagined. Okay, I'm not going to say anything because that was like really upsetting. And he says, I don't know where it came from. You know. And then there's another instance I wanted to mention. And that involved, it's something that happened in the San Francisco Bay Area where I live. And it involved a Kenyan writer by the name of Ngugi wa Thiong'o. I don't know how many of you have read his work, but he is one of the most revered writers in Africa, on the continent of Africa. He's published, maybe some of you know, I've heard of his book, Decolonizing the Mind. Okay, that's Ngugi wa Thiong'o. He just published a new book, which is really great. I'm reading it now. It's called Wizard of the Crow. He's been on tour with that book, came to San Francisco from Irvine, California, where he's now teaching, and was staying in a hotel, Hotel Vitale, which is one of those boutique hotels, you know, one of those kind of, you know, swanky, sort of small hotels, but Random House was paying for it, right? His publishing company. That's what. And so he's sitting there one morning reading the newspaper, and this employee of the hotel walks over to him and says to him, I am sorry, but only guests are allowed to use this space. Now, Googie is, I think, he's probably about 64, 65, and he may have had a sweatshirt on, you know. But, you know, if a white person had a sweatshirt on, nobody would ever assume that he wasn't or she wasn't registered in the hotel. And so Googie said to the guy, he says, "What makes you so certain that I am not a guest at this hotel?" And the employer wouldn't listen to him. And he said it again. And finally, they had to go over to registration. Now there's a big campaign, and the hotel manager has apologized. This is San Francisco, after all. And you know, this boycott of the hotel got started really quickly on the internet. And so the manager is saying he will donate money to anti-racist organizations, and he will do this, and he will do that. But the thing is, I spoke to Googie about this, and he said, I kept asking him, what makes you so certain? Because I saw this absolute certainty. Now, the man didn't say, you're black. He didn't say, you know, black people don't belong here. He was just certain that he could look at this man and tell that this man didn't belong there. Just like the cops who shot Sean Bell could look at this young brother and his friends in the club, and he could tell that they dealt in drugs, they were criminals, that they deserved to be shot. Exactly. So I want us to think about this certainty, this self-certainty, as a way in which racism expresses itself. It doesn't have to be about the fact that the person, or there doesn't have to be anything explicit about the race of the person. It's just, I know you should not be here. It's like your sheriff said when Negan accepted the prisons and the hospitals and a couple of other categories from the evacuation order. Apparently at the press conference, Sheriff Gusman was asked to answer the question as to why the prisoners were exempted. And he said, we need to keep them here because this is where they belong. This is where they belong. They are prisoners. This is where they belong. So I want us to think about this question of racism and this self-certainty. And I want us to ask, where does racism live today? Where did it reside in the past? And how do we identify those spaces that are so haunted by racism today? So we can actually talk about migrations of racism. Because, you know, we used to be able to understand it. We could say exactly what was racist and what wasn't. And now it's not that easy. And that is because racism itself changes. It moves, it travels, it migrates, it transmutes itself. Now, when Hurricane Katrina struck, over 6,000 human beings were locked up in the Orleans Parish Prison. And you know that this is one of the largest city jails in the country. And so actually I have this quote that Sheriff Gusman said when it was announced that the prisons would not be evacuated. He said, "We're fully staffed. We're under our emergency operations plan. We've been working with the police department. So we're going to keep our prisoners where they belong." And this is that same certainty, the certainty of racism, the certainty that appears to be colorblind, but is actually where attitudinal racism has migrated. I think we can discover racist attitudes in that certainty. Orleans Parish Prison was where prisoners belonged under any and all circumstances. They belonged out of sight, away from view. As one of the children said who was removed there from the juvenile facility, we were, quote, treated like trash. Sheriff Gussman was saying, basically, prisoners belong in a trash can with the top closed shut. And so there was this disaster within a disaster, as the ACLU National Prison Project put it, a disaster that we could not see, a disaster that went unrecognized because few people thought that prisoners deserved to be treated as human beings, because few people recognized prisoners as having rights, as having human rights. And so prisoners were locked in their cells and the flood water was rising and there was no way to get them out. There was no clean water. They were forced to drink water with feces floating around in it. We heard about the horrible conditions at the Superdome and at the convention center, and they were horrendous. And it's interesting that both of those places were considered, to a certain extent, places of incarceration for a largely black population. But we did not hear about the people being forced to remain in the flooded spaces of the OPP. We did not know that children had been taken there. And if you look at the ACLU's report called Treated, I think it's called Treated Like Trash? Abandoned and Abused. If you look at the ACLU's, I'm not talking about the ACLU, you're right. That's the report about OPP. I'm thinking about the juvenile, that was called Treated Like Trash, yeah. And then, of course, another 700 or so people were arrested during the hurricane, and Merlene Madden was one of them. And then they called Burl Kane. I was shocked that he was still the warden of Angola. You know, because I saw The Farm, that documentary, and I read Tom Burgess' book, God of the Rodeo, and read about the way in which Burl Kane tried to get him to share the profits from the book with him before he would agree to be, you know, before he would sign the consent form. And, well, anyway. And if any of you know anything about Burl Kane, you know that, at least in that documentary, he gave the impression that one of his favorite activities was conducting executions in Angola, but holding the hands of the people who were being killed in order to usher them on their way to God. I mean, I know some people in Louisiana are... Well, anyway. Okay, don't let me get started there. Camp Greyhound. When he came to run that jail, that they called Camp Greyhound, they turned the Greyhound bus station into a jail, right? And when I heard about that, I immediately thought about Guantanamo. I immediately thought about Camp X-Ray in Guantanamo. It seems that the authorities here were more concerned with questions of confinement and control and law and order and with security in the negative sense. More attention was devoted to possible breaches of the law than to anything else. And in this sense, you might say that what we saw during Katrina was a local manifestation of the military practices and policies guiding the Bush administration's approach to Iraq. Wow. And to the whole so-called war on terror. Just as anyone who looks Arab or Middle Eastern or who is known to practice Islam is a potential terrorist, a potential enemy combatant, You know, think of all the people who are still locked up in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and all these prisons all over the world because they are suspected of being enemy combatants. Just as Merlene Mathen was suspected of being a looter because she is black and because she had food in her hands. And so when you think about the fact that the sheriff would not even consider the possibility of evacuating the prisoners before Katrina hit land, it was the same kind of racist certainty. When he was confronted with accounts of prisoners in the OPP, Gusman denied their claims altogether, and he said that you don't, quote, and I'm quoting, you don't rely on crackheads, cowards, and criminals to say what the story is. It was the same kind of racist certainty. He didn't say black crackheads. He didn't say black cowards. He didn't say black criminals. But each one of those words is a carrier of racism. And so it seems to me that it might be important for us to think about how the prison industrial complex contributes to and nourishes itself from and lives on racism. Now, I was asked to talk a little bit about the prison industrial complex, but you know what the prison industrial complex is, don't you? You do, don't you? I mean, it's not just all of those prisons that we see all over the country, jails and prisons. It's all of the connections, right? It's the connections that we begin to see in the 1980s when the social programs begin to be dismantled and when globalization of capital begins its ascent. And so capital, money, instead of being focused on the needs of people, increasingly goes into profitable areas. And so there are no resources for health care. There's no resources for housing subsidies. There's no. So then what happens is that these huge surpluses of populations who have no place anymore because there are no jobs for them. A lot of the factories have gone abroad, gone to the global south. And so people have no way to make a living. And so, I mean, it's not as if there was a conspiracy, but it was a kind of systematic conspiracy without people actually deciding that this was what was going to happen. And so the idea is to build more and more prisons to serve as receptacles for those people who no longer have a place because there is no longer jobs for them, there's no longer education for them, there's no longer welfare for them, there's no longer health care for them. This begins in the 1980s, the deindustrialization process, right? And we see it happening right now. In the global south. We see it happening in Africa. We see it happening in Latin America. You can go to countries where the poverty is so extreme because the IMF or the World Bank has decided you get a loan only if you can put it into a profitable sector. Not if you want to use the money for schools or not if you want to use the money for housing. And so what happens is that there are increasing numbers of people in countries in Africa, in Latin America, and in Asia who are considered to be garbage now. There's no place for them. And so they're building prisons all over. And in some countries, you see abject poverty. And against the backdrop of that abject poverty, you see the shiniest new prison using the most advanced and most sophisticated new technology. Now, something is wrong. Something is seriously wrong. And it seems to me that we see those contradictions right here in New Orleans. And perhaps you've heard about the connection that people often make between the prison industrial complex and slavery, right?
Yes.
You know about the 13th Amendment, right? And we all talk about the institution of the prison being haunted by slavery. I mean, I've heard a lot of talk about ghosts in New Orleans since I've been here, you know. Apparently the hotel where we're staying is haunted. But I really believe in ghosts. I do. But I believe in the ghost of history. And I don't know if we recognize those ghosts. And I see that OPP and Angola and CYC or YSC are haunted by slavery. Anybody who's seen the film The Farm cannot help making those connections. But there's something about the ghost of slavery I want to talk about this evening, especially as a way of understanding why black people are so easily labeled criminals, so easily identified with as the threat to law and order. Now, we know that the 13th Amendment abolished slavery, right? At least that's what they say. I just can't believe that we believed it. Like one little statement in the Constitution, you know, in an amendment is going to abolish this huge, complicated institution. And the 13th Amendment doesn't even tell us what slavery is. So it doesn't even say what it abolished. It just says slavery and involuntary servitude. But slavery was a lot more than involuntary coercive labor. You know, what are they talking about? Abolishing slavery as being based on human property or being based on social death or being based on racism? Because the racism is definitely still here. And the vestiges of slavery are definitely still here. But there's one vestige especially that I think we should be aware of this evening. And that is the extent to which black people, even though we assume that slaves were not recognized as legal personalities, were not recognized by the law, because, you know, slaves could never file suit or could never testify against anyone. But there were ways in which every single slave was recognized as legally accountable. And that is when a slave committed a crime. Now, if property commits a crime, you see what I'm saying? It can't be morally accountable. It can't be legally accountable. And the fact that there were so many different punishments for black people who were slaves that were far more severe than for white people who had committed the same crimes. So if you look at that accountability that has always been there, and you look at the fact that there are more black people in prison than any other group of people in this country, it seems like somehow or another we've allowed ourselves to believe that there was like due process there. And there are reasons why there's so many people in prison. But it seems to me that when black people became recognized as full citizens or recognized as having standing before the law, it's the same standing that we already had during slavery, and that is that kind of negative standing. The standing of guilt, the ability to be found guilty. And so now racism expresses itself under the sign of equality, under the sign of due process. The negative affirmation of the legal personality of black people continues to hold sway today. And the proof of the participation of black people in U.S. democracy is precisely the fact that they have received due process before being sentenced in such disproportionate numbers to prison. But the prison is the negative side of democratic freedom. Just as slavery used to furnish the evidence of freedom to people who weren't slaves. Yes. Slavery was a way of letting people know who weren't slaves that they were free, right? And in a lot of ways, that's the only way they knew that they were free, that they weren't slaves. Now, the prison does the same thing. We know that we're free because we're not behind bars. And besides, imprisonment has become so profitable. But I think I need to end now because I think I'm still on California time, and I'm going over a little bit the time that was allotted me. So let me conclude by saying that we want amnesty for all the prisoners of Katrina. We want amnesty. We want amnesty for everybody who is doing Katrina time. For everybody who's doing Katrina time. We want all municipal, state, and federal records of prisoners of Katrina expunged. These records should also be expunged from credit and employment agencies. No one should be tried, sentenced, fined, imprisoned, jailed, detained, involuntarily relocated, or deported. We call for amnesty to challenge how the prison industrial complex is used in times of disaster, while structural disasters like racism and poverty continue to be ignored. We call for amnesty as a means of examining community needs and encouraging genuine public safety in the reconstruction of New Orleans. And we here this evening, I think we all endorse the right to return. All right. I mean, I'm just coming from Houston, and I just met with many New Orleanians from Houston who want to come back. But the right to return should not be about the right to return to a city that the disaster capitalists like Halliburton are exploiting for profit. It should be about the right to return to a livable city, livable for poor and working people, a city with good schools and recreation, environmental safety, a city that does not direct all its resources into security and police and jails and prisons. In fact, what we call prison abolition, the abolition of prisons as a way of addressing a whole range of social problems that the prisons cannot even begin to address, when we call for prison abolition, decarceration, and the shifting of resources to improve people's health, their economic well-being, their educational opportunities, their cultural lives, that's all a part of the struggle for prison abolition. This is the New Orleans, this is the habitable city we should be thinking about when we demand amnesty for all of the prisoners of Katrina. Thank you very much. Wow.